This episode of AVXL was recorded on March 30th, 2018. We're going to talk fun with the new HDR Fury, our first impressions of ELAC's debut 2.0 speakers, Cambridge Audio's new Edge series, Monoprice's new monolith USB DAC, the battle to bring MLB baseball into Robert's home, and so much more.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater and audio gear, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
I was going to say there's no headphones in this show, but there will be headphones in this show.
You are off the cam jam. Can jam.
Can jam.
This weekend.
Next weekend.
Next?
Okay, good. This weekend, the boy turns six. The youngest boy turns six.
Good. This probably wouldn't be such a great weekend for Can Jam anyway, considering it the Easter holiday and other...
Well, I'm already on thin ice with the small creature because of the beard.
Okay.
Although, truly, watching the small creature, he can sing almost all of the lyrics to Black Flag's Rise Above, and two, to watch his interpretive dance when I throw on Edith Piaf, awesome.
Interpretive dance.
Truly a mutant after my own heart.
Good deal, man.
Oh, my goodness. I'm Patrick Norton.
I am still Robert Herron.
And this is AVXL, where we talk to you about home theater gear and audio gear and
hell
content
yes.
And mayhem and getting the best experience you can get. I'm just going to throw it out there. You are battling Major League Baseball, your ISP, your traditional VPN relocation surface, and your networking hardware in an attempt to get around the blackouts so you can watch the Oakland A's.
You know, I try not to push it too hard because technically they could just take my money that I've paid already for MLB TV and just cancel my ass.
Because you're trying to get around their blackouts.
Breaking the terms and conditions.
Good Lord, man. You live 3 miles from the stadium. Get your ass out and go sit in the stands.
That was the other thought I had yesterday. I am literally two train stops away from the Coliseum.
Well, they were. Okay, so...
Anyway.
This is not a baseball show, but it's funny in particular because the Oakland A's decided last year they were finally going to open up the third tier of seats, the nosebleed seats, and sell them for $15. I am curious if they're doing that this year.
Season pass season ticket or whatever they call that. $150 starting. So you can go to every game for just that one low fee.
I can actually afford that as a
parent. It is probably a nosebleed seat, but anyway.
Who cares?
Yes, it is annoying.
But there's no air conditioning up there.
No.
No.
And you can't you're way up there. And although the cool people do sit up there, though. I will admit, I've always found the quality of the fan, mm-hmm. be it any sporting event, when you get up to those top seats, can be pretty fun-filled.
They're either say that. Awesome or terrifying.
Well,
is awesome. They still have the $15 tickets. We should just stop talking about this.
Nope.
Thieving bastard.
Yep. You have an evening game tonight. I'm looking forward to it. And yes, the blackout restrictions are annoying. They should go away, and they haven't. Right. And I do my best to get around it when possible. I love traveling outside of my my broadcast area because then it's like, oh, I have no broadcast or blackout restrictions or anything like that. But
I can't really throw that many rocks because I have been known. My first actual VPN purchase was so I could watch a Canadian curling site that would block US IP addresses. So it's not like I'm a bastion of purity in geo-relocation.
Let's just say my ISP, I don't believe, has anything to do with it. I will say it's some of the hardware I'm using. And I will just make a blanket statement saying it was way easier to avoid these blackout restrictions with my older gear. Namely, my PlayStation 3 that had some certain DNS abilities that I'm finding a lot of new devices simply don't support. Mm-hmm. And as well, I'm also finding that some of my latest and greatest networking gear is also part of the problem, perhaps, as well as the Roku, which turns out to be one of the more difficult things to manipulate in ways that are more conducive to avoiding these blackout situations. But anyway, at the very least, if nothing else, 90 minutes after the game's over, I can watch it no matter what. Or I can jump on the damn train and 10 minutes later, I'm standing there for my local home games. Anyway, enough of that. I'll get into that at some point. I don't want to ruin my relationship with MLB, but...
It's okay.
They're
probably going to cause the podcast to be delisted off iTunes or something.
This needs to stop. this whole blackout restriction. I don't understand how it benefits anyone. Paid customers, local fans. It
benefits television, and it's all about the television.
You know, it benefits
dollars.
The cable and satellite providers and anyone
who
who's providing
the big money.
Yeah, NBC, and in this case for my local team, it's a Comcast channel that is your only option for watching it on TV. It's not over the air, and yeah.
But I mean, MLB.TV still probably, you know, there's a reason Disney bought the technology arm of the MLB for the to provide the foundation for the next generation streaming service, because it's just that
you got people like me handing over good. The money every year for it, and I truly enjoy it for what it is.
And the video streaming quality, it's, I don't know, it's still amazing.
It's okay. It's pretty good 720p-ish.
That's probably the longest sports ball digression we've ever made on the show.
Perhaps.
On episode 73, Fernando asks us how he could enjoy... he's looking for the latest HDR formats on his new 4K TV, but he's got an older AVR that's not HDR compatible. He's kind of trying to... He's in that position where there's a bunch of stuff coming, and his AVR isn't that old.
True.
We were trying to figure out how we could eke a couple more years out of his AVR before he replaces it.
Indeed. And lo and behold, I had a email drop into my inbox the other day detailing some new products from HD Fury. And thank goodness for the sharp-eyed listener at Evan Adams. He tweeted about the same exact product I had caught a glimpse of, basically, from the good folks at HD Fury. And these are the folks known for creating appliances that can sit between incompatible devices. And in terms of your HDCPs and your HDMIs and those various incompatibilities that can exist between devices in your display and make things work. And one of their new products is called the AVR Key. And this is a $150 device. It is not very large. And it effectively takes your HDMI output from, say, a device that supports 4K, HDR, all the latest formats, and then allows you to separate out just the audio and the video into two separate streams through separate HDMI connections. Simple. You simply add this into your device, feed that audio to your AVR, and then send that unaltered video right to your brand new 4K display. So that would be one way to do it. This is a $150 device, and you would have to, most likely, to make it more useful, pair it with a HDMI switch that also supports HDMI 2.0, HDCP 2.2, and all your HDR formats, just to give you some flexibility, because you're pretty much just you'll be running that one connection to your AVR for the audio.
Right.
Effectively, you'll still be able to then run all of your connected devices that would run through that switch through the AVR key and then to the TV to maintain that say Dolby Vision or HDR 10 experience that you're trying to get from a variety of different external devices. So you could say for $200 or less, this would enable anybody with maybe an AVR that they just really love, but it doesn't support the latest 4K formats, let alone your HDR formats, to just be able to continue to use those devices for just the audio side of it, and to be able to split that off ahead of time in order to provide it to the TVs that do support it. So it is an option, and it's out there. And I'm actually quite pleased that something does exist like that. AVR Key is kind of nice in the sense that it is also controllable with the app on your phone, mm-hmm. if you have iOS or Android, to make it a little bit easier in terms of setup. It did have one kind of oddball warning about the particular product in terms of if you are feeding this the full 600 megahertz signal from something, say, outputting 4K with uncompressed color and your full bandwidth for audio, it's saying that you may experience a very short sound dropout after 3 to 5 hours of use. And then, and if that's going to be a problem for your general usability, they have a more expensive product called the Vertex that will offer similar features and even more. Actually, I want this new Vertex product because it also incorporates a scaler as well for some of my older devices that I would like to continue using in my test environments.
What's the price on the Vertex?
You know, that's a good question. Let me just see. I had the Integral. And that did everything the Vertex did except for the scaling. So, $350 for the Vertex.
So that's a $200 priced VIG.
Yeah, especially considering that you're still going to need a switch. Although something like the Vertex does include two ports. So it is, in a sense, like a two-port matrix switch. But still. Yeah. This is, it's a balance between how important is this functionality, whether you use an AVR key or something like the Vertex, and what you're going to spend getting that to work versus putting that money toward a new AVR down the road. So at least there is an option right now starting at $150.
$350 tends to be my budget for a Denon or Onkyo AVR, $350, $500. But if you just drop $2,000 on a state-of-the-art, top-of-the-line system from Marantz or Denon or Onkyo or anybody else, Anthem, they'll start rattling names off your Emotiva. $350 compared to the $5,000 you have into your super sophisticated system may be a perfectly reasonable price.
Totally. So,
speaking of perfectly reasonable, $300 for a set of fantastic speakers seems good to me. ELAC Debut 2.0, we talked about the announcement last week. ELAC was actually kind enough to send us out a full 5.1 setup. Their B6.2 left and right bookshelf speakers, a center channel, some surrounds, a subwoofer. We'll get into the 5.1 stuff later on.
Did they send you the front towers?
No, I got the speakers.
Okay.
You know, I love towers.
I do too, but
I am currently challenged to get towers into my living room in a way where my wife will not beat me to death with a hammer.
But as far as the standalones, those are called the B6s.
Yeah, the ELAC Debut 2.0 B6.2, those are the primary, the front channel speakers for the left and right channel. $300 a pair, like $20 more than the original Debut B6s. Cabinet's definitely sturdier and heftier.
They look great.
Yeah.
I mean, they look solid. They don't feel like a cheap
speaker
at all.
They're not using the vinyl wrap anymore. Oh. Apparently, the MDF is thicker. They added a big ring of bracing around the center of it. As we mentioned, you know, they're like 2 pounds heavier per cabinet. The cabinets are taller now because they moved that subwoofer port to the front instead of having it in the back. And the whole point of that is so you can shove the speaker into a bookshelf or back up against the wall without completely hammering the bass output on that. You know, 1-inch cloth dome tweeter, 6.5-inch Ehrman fiber woofer. The crossover dropped like 800 hertz down from 3,000 hertz to 2,200 hertz to give a cleaner sort of transition from the woofer to the tweeter. They're claiming 44 hertz to 35,000 hertz, and then the sensitivity is 87 hertz. And they're 6-ohm speakers, so they should be pretty easy to drive from your average AVR or inexpensive receiver or amplifier. You know, 87 hertz is not super sensitive, but it's not like an 84 hertz. And someday, or 84 dB efficient, not hertz. I don't know why I have hertz in there instead of dB decibels. We did our initial testing. I brought them over to Rob's house.
Yeah, you did.
And what I affectionately refer to as the hell room, which is Robert's living room, which is like 90% hard surfaces.
It's ridiculous.
And yeah, it makes, if a speaker is particularly sibilant or it places too much emphasis on the treble, this is a room that will make you turn the speakers off.
I did not build this room.
No, and I'm not doing it. But this is a classic. There's a whole lot of couch
environment
in this room.
And I absolutely love the way these speakers sound. And it is like, for the price point, I would be pressed to want to drop down to anything less. I think the physical size of the speaker is just about perfect. It provides a large enough driver and the tweeter separate. Compared to what's in this room right now, that's really what made me light up. I'm like, this is just the way it should be. Why is it so bad?
Well,
with our other speakers that are in this room.
Yeah, so. We won't. I don't know who made the other speakers in this room.
Let's not. Again, I had no choice in any of that.
Sometimes you move into a place and somebody else did the speakers. I was really impressed. Like I threw on Bob Marley and the Wailers, Three Little Birds, which is a song I've heard on everything from a jank AM car stereo with a single ripped speaker through $50,000 systems that are far beyond anything I'll ever be able to afford. It's a touchstone for me. I was really impressed with how much thud these speakers brought.
What were you driving the speakers with?
That's a New Force DDA 120. New Force was kind of making big noises around Class D, you know, all transistor, not transistor, integrated circuit, basic, you know, Class D amplification, switch amplification. So it allows you to put a lot of power in a very small box. And that's what I've been using at my desk at work with a set of ELAC Unifies.
Sounded great.
It's impressive. You can pick one of those up now for about $250. I think they were $600 new. It's part of the reason I brought that here is because it's really easy to carry because it's, you know.
Indeed.
It's about a quarter of a pizza box.
Half speakers will travel.
Yeah. I roll into Rob's office.
What the hell are you bringing?
I got an amp and speaker cables and a freaking 10-gauge extension cord. And
sounds beautiful, though.
I was impressed, right? We did some Punch Brothers, New York City, Chris Teeley's band. Another one of my primary test tracks, Clutch, Mice and Gods. Mostly because it has that opening. There's this relatively isolated kick drum at the opening of that, and it tells me a lot about sort of the mid to low end of the speaker I'm listening to. Yeah, they're really good.
The other thing I asked was if they had it in any other color besides black, and
I'm just happy it's not covered with the dust gathering vinyl.
There you go. But I was going to say, I do have a vinyl wrap shop down the street from me here, and they could do it up in something like prismatic colors of rainbow or whatever. But I was thinking either...
I want the unicorn vomit.
Either something white or black, I think is really... I mean, they're, you know, just for more placement options.
For what it's... I mean, okay, these
for
are...
For me personally, these I love are, black speakers.
These are speakers that are built to a price point, right? And to bring that sort of into perspective, when... So there's ELAC Unifies, right? When you look at the, what are they, $500 a pair right now, $450 a pair? And that's kind of my go-to, you know, for anything under $1,500 to $2,200. Because I will be perfectly honest with you, I drool over Kef's powered LS50s, the wireless LS50s. That is a fantastic piece of engineering. You don't have to buy a preamplifier. You don't have to buy any digital streaming devices. You don't have to buy an amplifier because everything's built into the speaker. And it's even got a subwoofer out, so if you want more low end on that. But if you look at like the Unifies, which are, let's call it $500 a pair since I can't Google right now. Let me see. Yeah, $499.99. When you go to the Slim, right, the ELAC's European distribution was like, you know, we need thinner speakers in Europe because the rooms are smaller. And could you do something in sort of a piano black or a piano white? When you go from the UB5, which is $500 a pair, to the Unify Slim, which requires a tremendous, you know, they do like three coats of paint, I think polishing, and you're looking at something...
A premium finish.
I like that. Right? And it's the same internal volume, so they should sound the same, but they're a little bit thinner, a little bit deeper, and they go from $500 a pair to, it looks like the price is down a little bit, $750 a pair. For some reason, I thought it was a considerably higher jump, but it costs money to put a really nice finish on things.
True.
So.
And I think the simulated wood finish of the new B6-2s are, they're not ugly speakers in any way. And no. They have all the right things, including the connectors on the back in terms of your banana plug jacks and things like that. Everything looks good.
Mr. Jones put some very nice, you know.
Not feeling any creaking, or they feel solid. Mm-hmm. They feel like something that would last. And that's simply all I really want to do now is just spend more time listening to them. So. And somehow, maybe I can just get away with replacing every speaker in this room with those. And
I'd have theories on that.
I would be so happy. Yeah. But that ain't happening.
Well,
I'm moving first.
That's a conversation for another day.
Yes, indeed.
50th anniversary of Cambridge Audio this week. Their big original amplification, the P40, came out 50 years ago.
Not Cambridge Soundworks.
Not Cambridge Soundworks, yeah. You made that mistake once, and I about again. Peed myself. I was like, no.
Not that company.
No.
The other Cambridge.
The
original.
Cambridge Audio. You know, in England. And that was the first amp to use a toroidal transformer, which is pretty much used by all the amps these days. If you pick up an amp that weighs 50 pounds, it probably has a toroidal transformer in it. Big old ball of copper. Well, spool of copper. So they announced to celebrate their 50th anniversary, the new Edge series, an amp, a preamp, and an integrated amp. And Cambridge, of course, is the, I will affectionately call them, self-proclaimed standard bearers of British sound, which is to say a neutral, accurate, you know, what's in the track comes out of their gear, and they don't color it up.
We're not screwing
around.
I'll
say tart it up, since I think there's at least one person at Cambridge Audio who will laugh when I say that their products don't tart up the audio. So the Edge NQ preamp with network players, essentially, it's a preamp, it's a network player, it's got one of their Stream Magic modules into it. So it functions, you know, for Chromecast audio, AirPlay, Spotify Connect, Bluetooth, AptX. And you can run all of the files through it. And it's a preamp, so you can plug all of the things into it.
Very nice.
And it's essentially they've taken kind of some of the ideas from their Azure lineup and made it into a smaller, denser, and I mean dense in a nice sort of full of goodness, not you know, the slowpoke who you didn't want to deal with tutoring in junior high school. But
God, it's a beautiful design.
Yeah.
The preamp I'm looking at right now with the full color display on the front, but otherwise a single knob.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's also a company, you
gorgeous.
Know, this is a you know, $4,000 piece of hardware.
Oh, okay.
So well, it still, should be pretty. But I also love, right?
It looks good.
When you look at the pictures of the backplate on this, you know, there's like the USB audio input. That's D5. D4 is the TV. D3, I want to say, is RCA jack for coaxial. D2, D1 are SPDIF connectors. You know, they've got XLR connectors on the back. But one of the first things I noticed in RS-232 controllers, but one of the things that I noticed that really made me happy is everything's printed right side up and then upside down, so that if you are leaning behind and reconfiguring things, you're not trying to read things upside down and backwards.
I've simply become used to that, but now somebody is taking care of every little detail.
They put Ethernet on it, which I think is a big plus. You can add, you know, Ethernet just makes so many things simpler. There's a link out, which I presume is to allow you to trigger the amplifier power. There's an optional Bluetooth antenna mount, it looks like, or a Bluetooth antenna mount on there, RS-232C, so if you want to get it into your home integration. This is a high-end product, a flagship product, so it's not cheap.
Beautiful. With a separate amp, then, you would require to drive this sucker.
Yeah. So, you know, and you know, frequency response, 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz, 0.1 dB, which is somewhere way beyond what's audible by humans, 0.008%, THD from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz. Again, you know, like ridiculous specs. They do all their tuning. You know, they have kind of a crew of people that listen to their products and decide on when they have the Cambridge audio sound.
It looks like this is also a product, too, that's completely, as much as humanly possible, designed and built in-house.
Mm-hmm.
Their own unique designs, probably decades of knowledge pouring into every one of these products. And yes, I want to hear this.
I want to
experience how the Edge NQ actually manages everything you want to throw at it.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons.
And then add one of their, I'm sure, beautiful amps to go with it.
Somebody was telling me, like, oh, I want to get insert name of cell phone company. They've got a Sonos competitor. I'm like, well, wait until you see what the software is, because the whole reason, you know, Sonos is so beloved is because it just delete expletive works. And, you know, I think Cambridge is their sort of brand they're brand conscious enough, and they don't make so many products that they can afford to screw something up. So, which I think is a positive thing.
Indeed.
Yeah, the integrated amplifier, again, ridiculous specs. The 100 watts RMS into 8 ohms, 200 watts RMS into 4 ohms. Frequency response, 3 hertz to 80,000 kilohertz, plus or minus 1 dB. You know, 0.002 THD at rated power. You know, so they're going for super, 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 super clean audio. And I was really curious, kind of the product that, you know, I'm very curious to you know, basically pump to stream audio to the Edge NQ. But the other thing they have is the Edge W power amplifier, which is a relatively affordable $3,000. I read a lot of stuff that Nelson Pass has written because, you know, about the time I started getting into audio 1,000 years ago, he had gone from Threshold to sort of Pass Labs and doing amps like the Alef and stuff, which was the first time we'd really seen high power Class A amplifiers.
Is he with Cambridge now? Or
No. He lives like an hour north of here.
Gotcha.
Or no, I think he lives out. He's probably like a 2-hour drive from here. Someday I'll get a chance to talk to him.
A respected industry guru. Or
he's like an amp genius.
Gotcha. Okay.
He worked for Threshold. He's mostly known for doing Pass Labs. He's big in the DIY community. He's created those little amplifiers that I built were from a Nelson Pass design. And so I love the idea. Anytime you see somebody who's trying to reduce the component count in an amplifier, I always find that interesting, right? Because the idea that you have the shortest path for the audio. So there's 14 components from from the RCA jack on the back to the, you know, speaker binding posts. There's 14 components.
Keeping it simple.
Keeping it very simple. And it's, they describe it, the release I saw just called it Class XA, which to me sounds a lot like high bias Class AB. So,
okay.
I could try to describe Class A versus Class AB amplification, but I'll basically say that Class A amplification allows you to provide all of the voltage to the amplifier at all times so that no matter what happens, the amplifier can basically, it'll handle it. It'll handle it, right? Class AB is what the vast majority of audiophile or audio amplifiers are.
Well, that's cool. So they have the Edge NQ, which is their preamp with the network player, and that's coming soon.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is just a fantastic design. But then now they have a couple of different integrated amplifier options to pair with that.
Well, they have a dedicated amplifier and an integrated amplifier.
Gotcha.
So, but yeah, so Class XA to me sounds a lot like high, like Class AB, a high bias Class AB, where it operates exclusively in Class A. I'm gonna get an answer back from an engineer in Cambridge, and we'll come back to that next week. But
good deal.
100 watts at 8 ohms, 200 watts at 4 ohms, and they claim it'll quote almost hit 400 watts at 2 ohms, which is a polite way of saying our amp can kick your amp's ass unless you have a particularly out-of-control amp.
Yeah.
So. Cheap? No.
No.
But really, really pretty?
Yes. Very thoughtful design
with,
in my opinion, kick-ass styling in terms of just, it's elegant. If there's ever a good time to use that term, it's when you can reduce all of the controls down to maybe a really cool knob, just one, on a nice brushed, finished face to keep it simple.
Right.
And then the appropriate inputs on the back, including with the network stuff. Oh, yeah. There's a lot going on there. And granted, it's definitely not for everyone, but if you're in that class and you're looking for, you know, something different, something exquisitely made, apparently, I would definitely want to preview these as soon as possible. I can't wait till they come out.
They look
out.
Very shiny.
They look gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Gorgeous, gorgeous.
Gorgeous. I mean, I love my Yamahas and my other brands in terms of, you know, hey, I can use a tablet I already own to provide interesting control effects and things like that and other features. But this just sounds like an audiophile dream.
Yeah.
With some solid.
I'll be very curious to hear it, you know. I mean, and look, I've you know,
like the built some pretty good sounding.
I've built some pretty good sounding stuff with, you know, $25 Lepi or Lepi or Leapy. Since there seems to be three different companies selling the same amplifier now on,
we know what you're talking about,
on Amazon, but you know, we can start you at $25, but we'll go listen to the pretty stuff too. Mm. Hey, if you're anywhere near Chicago, the middle of April, there's a show called Axpona. I've never been to it, but Cambridge Audio is going to be there. I think their offices are in Chicago. Cambridge Audio will be there. Periodic Audio comes to mind.
Mid-April.
Okay, I'll send you a link.
I need to head that way sooner. Then later.
Yeah. So. Well, you should schedule it around Axpona, get into Chicago.
There's something going around or happening on the 15th. Well, one, tax time here in the U.S., but...
And then I burst into tears.
There's something else I need. There's something else going on the 15th. I just was looking at my calendar, and I'll have to see. But hey, if I can get out to Illinois, I'm going to do
you
it.
Should.
I'd like to see those in person and actually put some ears on them.
It's one of those shows where there's, the one I've been to the most is Rocky Mountain Audio Fest. I'll be down at the LA Audio Show in June. Rocky Mountain Audio Fest is in October. If you want to hear a whole bunch of really interesting stuff that you will never normally ever get a chance to hear, it's a good way to do it. At John Livings tweets, Monoprize versus AudioQuest comparison, ?
What's he looking at?
He's looking at Monoprize has a new USB DAC.
Very cool.
What's interesting, it's a $100 monolith USB DAC. So it's under that monolith lineup where they've been putting those ATI manufacturers, amplifiers, and a bunch of other stuff they do.
Is this something that would have like format support built in?
So essentially, this is like an AudioQuest Dragonfly or Shits Full of Two, where a USB, you know, you take a USB cable, either you plug it into the in the case of like this Monoprice USB DAC or the AudioQuest Dragonfly, it's a USB thumb drive with a headphone jack on the end of it. You plug it into your USB port. You know, it basically takes all the audio support, audio formats it supports, and it converts them into delicious audio for your ears. I haven't heard the new Monoprice monolith USB DAC.
But whose DACs?
So let's talk about this, right? So it's powered by an ESS 9018 K2M. That's the new two-channel version of their 9018. Or maybe it's the 9018, the 8-channel 9018s that have failed channels. Maybe those become 9018
K2Ms. You know, they are just to the south of us, I believe.
Yes.
I was doing a job.
They were bought by TI a few years ago.
Next to them. at another company I won't name off the top of my head.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a classic audiophile DAC, right? It supports up to 32-bit, 384 kilohertz audio, which I don't really believe in high-res audio, but if you want to play back high-res audio, this will do it. You know, it's a slightly higher signal-to-noise ratio than the original 9018, like 133 dB. DNR versus 129 dB. Those are also, by the way, measurements that you will never get in the real world and far beyond anything you can hear.
Right, but in terms of them engineering the product, they went out of their way to at least make it better than what happened before.
But yeah, I mean, a lot of the sort of like noise specs you see for, especially for individual components, they're kind of like Ethernet speeds where there's the theoretical speed and there's what everybody in the physical world sees.
This particular component is better, but in the grand scheme of how it was integrated within the product.
Well, that's a big deal, right? So let me finish off talking about this Monolith USB DAC. A couple of volume control button cutouts on the side. So those are basically little plasticky things or metally things that press into switches on the circuit board inside the thumb drive. And they're talking about a 2-volt RMS at 600 ohms load, which, if I'm doing my math correctly, essentially says that unless you have 600 ohms, you know, headphones that are staggeringly difficult to drive, the vast majority of headphones you might own, this will cause your eardrums to meet in the center of your skull if you turn it all the way up.
Plenty of power.
If you're not careful. So before I get into the comparison, let me say that I am a huge fan of a lot of monoprice products, right? If you have 20 bucks or if you're tired of teens that destroy headphones, there's just about nothing that can compete with Monoprice's 8323 premium hi-fi DJ style over-the-ear pro headphones. Their name, not mine. They sell for 16 bucks. I think they cost like 25 bucks if you have Amazon Prime.
That's a great starting place.
Yeah, I've been recommending them for years. My home theater and all my stereo rigs, by the way, are wired with Monoprice cable. The wire cutter made Monoprice's $99 9723 12-inch 150-watt powered subwoofer famous by declaring it the best budget subwoofer.
Hey, I'll just throw in their HDMI cables. They're 4K certified cables for 18 gigabit.
I think between the two of us, you know, I literally have...
And the speaker wire.
I own several hundred feet of their speaker wire.
I have installed...
You know, their CL2 in-wall stuff. I use their 12-gauge stuff for my speakers. Oh. If you're from a wire company and you think
their CL2 rated speaker wire is probably my favorite.
It's good stuff. ATS Monolith amps are built in California by ATI. I originally thought that was a rumor, but it turns out when Audioholics did the review, they confirmed. And ATI has built amplifiers for some of the best amplifiers ever sold in the United States were ATI amplifiers in a different case with a different brand on the front. Or maybe they were customized. But ATI, I own two ATI amplifiers I bought used. They are bomb-proof.
And so you figure Monoprice probably approached them going, you know what, we like the way you guys do things. Here's the target we're trying to hit price point-wise. Mm-hmm. Can we do something?
Yeah.
And it's like, they're like, yes.
And all the reviews I've seen on those Monolith amps are positive.
Good to know.
All of that said, right, this is at least the second USB DAC that's shown up on Monoprice.com. And I noticed with a lot of USB DAC manufacturers, they make one and they make it forever until they figure out how to make something better.
Right.
And usually over time, the cost drops down. That's been really interesting to watch. For example, AudioQuest, like the original Dragonfly, the Dragonfly 1.2, the black and the red, or if you look at shit,
I want the full of two.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm almost looking at things more on the design side of it rather than how it may actually perform or sound. Mm-hmm. Shit's full of two. It's just like, when I look at that, that's what I want sitting on my desk. I love the way that looks. However, I now want to hear what Monoprice is doing with this particular one.
So it's got a good DAC chip, but it's not just about the DAC chip, it's about how it's implemented. You know, I've heard some super cool guy USB DAC chips that sounded like crap. They were cheap, but because of some staggeringly poor choices in either how it was laid out or the components or whatever was going on, maybe they were, I don't know what, you know, I've had things that I verified that it was a legit DAC from a legit manufacturer, but the implementation was atrocious. You know, the legendary Northwest Audio guy says PCB layout is everything.
I should show you what I'm using with my PC right now.
Don't.
You know, I think it sounds pretty good.
Well, I'm teasing you because I'm trying to think of which motherboard you might have.
Oh, no, it's not. I am actually using a USB DAC.
Okay.
But ultra generic. Who knows? Who knows what the actual
DAC
is?
Well, here's the thing is, you know,
paired with the particular headphones I'm using, it actually, compared to other things I have used, and yes, I actually did try to use the stuff built right into the motherboard for a while. If the stars are aligned just right, it sounds okay, but the additional noise or... wow, I want to use the front port on a computer instead of, you know,
it's amazing how much noise the wiring to the headphone jack on the front of a PC.
Little things like that
can
add up. And that's what is nice about USB in the sense of you remove all of that. You get it to just be digital all the way out. And then that amplifier is external and then simply driving the headphones from that point.
Well, it's also something where it's changed so much in the last, like, I'll call it like the last 10 years, 5 years, right? Because, you know, if you have an iPhone, there's a really nice DAC and a reasonable headphone app in here. The Android phones you've got everything from sort of the LG's audiophile phones down to, you know, some everyday quality near flagship phones. So some of the major manufacturers have an incredibly weak amplifier, which can create
problems.
You see
what Sony's doing. I miss their phones.
Well, and our friends over at the Wirecutter spent a lot of time listening to DACs, and these are some of the people with the best trained ears I know. And I want to quote Laura Dragon here, who says, you know, when they did blind testing, they found in many cases there was a very slight improvement over what you get from the headphone jack of a typical phone or computer.
Okay.
And it used to be back in the day.
Dramatic difference.
There used to be a dramatic difference. And especially if you have...
Audio is the afterthought.
These days, especially if you have a high-quality laptop or a high-quality phone or a high-quality motherboard in your desktop, you're not going to notice as much difference. But, you know, a lot of DAC claims are, I'm going to quote Lauren again here, placebo or confirmation bias. You'll notice when people do blind testing, they tend to not pick the right DAC a lot of the time. So that said, I have some definite DAC preferences. I have some lust issues over, you know, the AK4490. If you have a very, very good set of headphones or speakers and you have quality amplification, and most importantly, you have good source material, you're paying for the premium level of Spotify, you're paying for the lossless title, you've ripped your FLAC collection, you'll start to hear things, you know, they tend to be subtle, they tend to be details. You know, one of the things I uncovered recently when I was experimenting with a particularly high-end DAC was not realizing that there was a ride cymbal going on behind a bunch of guitar noise in a track I've been listening to for 30 years. And those are the moments I really love where I'm like, oh, yes, there's a piccolo in there. So
understood,
you know,
though.
For a lot of people, you might be surprised.
But you mean even getting beyond, say, the types of headphones that require careful driving. Like I'm thinking like planar magnetics and some of them that require an above average driving system to make
like
them sound appropriate.
Fostex T50RPs.
Ignoring those though, does it even tighten up further when you're dealing
it's
I understand when you're dealing with unique demands of a particular technology of headphones, but when it comes to the others though.
It's really funny. You can't really do A/B testing on like headphones and DACs yourself for one simple reason, right? Because it's almost impossible. You know, if you want to have true blind A/B testing, one of the most critical things you have to do is to actually have the volume between the different things you're testing be as close as you can. Because as humans, I can play two things one after the other and have my curtain up so you can't see what's going on. And humans will generally pick the louder one of the two. And one of the great things about DACs for DAC salespeople is that almost invariably the DAC is going to be louder than whatever it was originally plugged into, whether it's a laptop or a desktop or a,
it's like a bright TV.
Yeah, it is like a bright TV
in
the walls
TV
of Costco. The nice thing is that there are a lot of really great DACs. And the most DACs are thoughtfully built and well implemented. You know, I think there are, you know, as you spend a lot more money for a DAC, you start to get a lot more features to play around with. And these are all we're talking about here is entry level DACs, right? $100. You know, if you want to eliminate to me, if you have good source files and you've got your first good set of headphones and you want to be like, I don't want to think about whether or not my laptop or my desktop or my phone is screwing up my audio, you go out and you buy an AudioQuest Dragonfly or you buy a shitful of two.
Right.
And I'll be honest with you, I've talked to the guys at...
I realize I need to upgrade my headphones before I start diving into DACs. I don't own a decent pair of headphones.
We have some
earphones that
start
are
with
okay.
A pair of Sony MDR7506s. That is a classic, or, you know, a Grado SR80.
Yep.
So, you know, if you've got a good pair of headphones, right? And you've got your source material sorted out. And you want to just stop thinking about whether or not the DAC and the headphone amp and your laptop or your phone or your desktop is compromising your experience. Go spend $100 on an AudioQuest Dragonfly Black or $200 for an AudioQuest Dragonfly Red. That's a lot of people love that DAC. The shit full of two, you know, has an AKM DAC inside of it. I'm really impressed with, and it's got a volume knob, which I am particularly in love with because, you know,
that's what I want.
Yeah, there's not enough
design.
There's not enough volume adjustment on my iPhone. You know, and both of these companies are all about audio. Now, I'm going to get some email that it's going to tell me that I should be burnt in hell for recommending an AudioQuest product and I'm a fool and they sell $10,000 cables, but I'm not recommending a $10,000 cable. I'm talking about a $100 product that kind of redefined a product category.
A person might come at me like that.
You know, and Gordon Rankin, the guy who engineers their USB audio DACs, is a pretty talented individual. The crew at Shit, they're really about, you know, direct sales of products at the best price they can deliver with the best technology they can do inside of it. And they don't care if you want tubes or if you want solid state or if you want to spend the money for a multi-bit DAC or if you want to, you know, do a more traditional, more affordable DAC. They deliver it. And, you know, as much as I like what Monoprice does with a lot of their products, I think there are probably better supported products that are better understood. You know, and maybe, who knows, maybe I will listen to the Monoprice Monolith USB DAC and be like, this is the DAC I have waited my whole life for. But I find it difficult to believe that for the same price, they can do something that's going to be that much better than the Shitful of Two or the AudioQuest Dragonfly.
Right.
You know, and I know those two companies are going to be around.
As long as it competes strongly, that's just a good thing. It gives people more options. So,
you know, I mean, you know,
I think the point you made also about, look, if you're making investments in headphones and you're still connecting them to, not suspect, but perhaps not the best driver in terms of making the sound their greatest. There are options at price points starting at about $100 on up.
Who knows? It's possible that you and I may AB your $13, you know, USB audio adapter from Amazon and have difficulties telling it from the $100 adapter.
That's the scary part.
Something to think about. A lot of times you will read reviews of products, you know, and it changed everything. It did their taxes. It fed the dog. It picked up the poop in the neighbor's yard. And by the way, the audio, and it's I've heard some of these products, you know, and while I've heard good quality, reasonable audio, it's shocking to realize that you know, until you get into the really subtle stuff, there may not be nearly as much difference as you would think between, you know, the DAC in your, you know, desktop and the $100 DAC and the $300 DAC and the $5,000 DAC. You know, I got to say, I've heard some, you know, four-digit audio gear that's not worth four digits because I can buy a three-digit piece of audio gear. Now, the three-digit piece of audio gear may not have as nice a case.
Understood.
Or as sophisticated a branding, but
dollar cost isn't everything.
Right.
And at the same point, though, there are reasons people want that sort of experience as well.
Well, and it's
to each his own.
I'm looking at the Monoprice, and if the Monoprice was $30, I'd be like, buy it, listen to it. If you like it, keep it. But I know there are two outstanding products at the same price point.
Yep.
So I'm going to point you to the
tough category to lead in.
Yeah.
Considering what has come before you has done a very, very, very good job.
Yeah.
So consider that.
I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. Probably took too long to say it. I apologize, but you know. Phil, a.k.a. Jedi Mister or Meister, tweets at AVXL, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton. You guys have mentioned various popular subwoofer brands in the past, but have you guys ever looked at Rhythmic Audio subs with their active servo tech? I've got dual F-15s with a DSP speakers or DS speakers, D speakers. I can never get that company name right.
DS speakers.
Antibode 8033C, and they're magical. And the first thing I have to say, because I have to say it, is I can no longer hear the word magical without thinking of Agent Coulson of S.H.I.E.L.D. Tahiti, it's a magical place.
Sure is.
Rhythmic Audio is spelled with a K. Rhythmicaudio.com is the website.
Wait, so they make subs? Yeah. Rhythmic Audio?
Rhythmic Audio makes subs.
This thing called the Active Servo, is that a separate piece of tech? Or is that something integrated?
Well, it's
I'm confused.
It's built into... Okay, well, it's... So
or can
these
it be
are powered...
One?
So Rhythmic Audio makes powered subwoofers. One of the technologies they use in that is called their direct servo technology. So when you have a speaker, right, you've got the cone. The cone is attached to a voice coil. The voice coil has power applied to it, and that moves against the magnet, and that creates the movement, that creates the exciting of the molecules, that creates the sound. That
usually driven by a signal from a receiver
an amplifier.
Or an amp. Yeah.
These days, most people, I think, are running self-powered subwoofers. But in the case of Rhythmic Audio, they have a second coil that is outside of the voice coil of the subwoofer's monitor that is, quote, used to generate a feedback signal, which is then used to correct any difference between the original and the reproduction. The sensing coil acts as a microphone, and the feedback is sent to the servo board, where the necessary corrections are made instantly without the use of any active circuits. And it's supposed to be really, really fast. The idea is that
sounds like a cool piece of technology.
Yeah, I'm curious, right?
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you. I've heard lots of subwoofers that don't have active servo technology that sound fantastic, or direct servo technology. But it's an interesting idea that they are monitoring the signal in real time to make sure the signal that is, you know, running through the voice coil is the same signal that came out of the amplifier, which I'm not entirely sure makes sense to me. But as many people have pointed out in the past, I majored in literature, not electrical engineering or audio engineering, and I have
now,
my
I limitations.
Now, I
get the concept of listening, or in a sense listening, to what the speaker is doing. And if you can real-time tweak it to produce something even more accurate and faithful to that original recording, more power to you. And it's just... I am more curious.
Yeah, so they've gotten very solid reviews on Audioholics. Audioholics looked at the FV15HP, which generates a whole lot of bass. And it's interesting. So the idea of that direct servo technology is that, you know, the sensing coil around the voice coil tells the servo board that's talking to the amplifier, or sending signal to the amplifier within the subwoofer, to try to make sure that everything is copacetic,
right?
That you don't have lingering effects from whatever is going on inside of that box. So the DS speaker, the Anti-Mode 8033, is essentially an equalizer that allows you to adjust the subwoofer. And I read a really great thread from an owner of the Anti-Mode 8033. And what I loved about it so much was that the DS speaker folks, basically, he captured sort of the signal that was, he created a frequency graph of the signal that was coming out of his subwoofer. And the first thing the people at DS speaker said was like, you need to move your subwoofers, right? Because, you know, the idea is that, you know, you put the speaker in the wrong place, you have problems with, you know, resonances or the room mode and
well, remember last week we were talking about chuffing of subwoofers, and I'm wondering if this would have been, just based on the technology in this particular setup, would it have been able to mitigate some of that kind of artifact?
In the case of that particular subwoofer, the problem was either that he brought a knife to a gunfight and he needed a bigger subwoofer.
Yes.
Which is, I think, was the given the subwoofer in question, I think that's 80% of the problem. Or he had managed to put the subwoofer in the worst possible spot for the room based on the frequency that port was tuned to. Or he just simply had it turned up so high that the subwoofer was working so hard that as soon as it, you know, it was chuffing left and right.
I think
the idea with this is that it's gonna.
I think Rhythmic Audio might be a great upgrade.
I think Rhythmic Audio might be a great upgrade.
We were talking about what were
or
those?
Or Shoe, you know, or the RSL Speedwoofer. But so what this does, what this thing does, the 8033 sends frequency sweeps to the calibration point or multiple points. And then it kind of, quote, measures the combined transfer function of the subwoofer and room system, right? Because nobody actually in the real world listens to a subwoofer in an anechoic chamber, right?
No.
So your room impacts the sound of the subwoofer. So that's why we talk about doing the subwoofer crawl and properly locating the subwoofer.
Yep.
And what this does is it then calibrates the signal coming, is being sent to the subwoofer, to give you the flattest low-end bass response.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Not inexpensive.
No. It sounds clever, and it's just something I'd like to experience more in person.
So We should email them and see if they
Heck
have
yeah.
dealers out here or something. We got to go listen to all the things.
Heck yes.
And that's when I abandoned my family and my job and became a Ronin in search of better audio products, right up to the point where my wife tracked me down and beat me to death with a hammer.
Indubitably, man.
You calibrated a Sony Z9D.
Yeah, you know what? This is a TV that's not exactly new either. This is the 2016 it was released. I want to say summertime. And it's still Sony's flagship. There is no better LCD that company is producing until I'm thinking probably this summer, maybe when they'll sneak something else out to replace it. However, this is I got a chance to try out my new calibration gear for the first time on this particular set, and it is not a cheap TV. I mean, currently the 75-inch version, I think, is still selling for $6,000 or so. So, $7,000 maybe in some cases. It's been as low as, I want to say, $5,000. So, 75-inch screen from 2016. At best, you're going to find it for about $5,000. What makes it so special? The light output. You consider a couple years ago what they were aiming for in terms of absolute light output. This thing measured 1,700 nits of light output.
Whoa.
With 95% DCI color coverage, and it was a magical experience. One, it's a fun TV to work on, and it calibrated beautifully, and it looked fantastic when I was done. However, just bringing this particular TV up and some of the new or not so new anymore, but some of the premium 2017 models from last year, including the A1E OLED and some of the higher-end LCDs that Sony produced, there has been a recent Dolby Vision update for these televisions. And it's worth realizing what it is exactly that Sony's doing. These TVs did not incorporate the full-blown Dolby chip that other manufacturers have integrated, like Vizio and LG in particular, for external devices. So pretty much any Dolby Vision compatible device, you could plug into one of those compatible LG or Vizio TVs, and it would just work. This update for these particular 2016 for the Z9D and the 2017 premium models, this type of Dolby Vision update is specifically for the streaming apps built in. Of course, that'll be no problem. However, for an external device to have this what I want to call Dolby Vision Lite, aka Dolby Vision low latency support, requires some of that processing to be handled by that external device. So these devices would need to be updated to have that kind of compatibility. And so far, it is very limited in terms of what you would be able to connect externally to one of these TVs and actually enjoy Dolby Vision support. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's Apple TV's 4K player, as well as Oppo's Blu-ray players, their latest generation, the 203 being probably the more popular, also being updated recently. Now, I just want to mention real quick that I was looking through the 2018 TVs we've been talking about, including that incredible 8AF OLED, as well as that sweet full-array local dimming X900F we talked about last week.
Mm-hmm.
I actually didn't see any mention of anything Dolby Vision related within those TVs. So I'm wondering if they're going to do another late launch of a firmware update, perhaps, to add this low latency support, or if in fact they'll actually incorporate full-blown Dolby Vision chips within them to provide the greatest amount of compatibility with these external devices. And since it's not listed already in the specs for these newest TVs for 2018, I'm going to assume it's all going to be this low latency version of Dolby Vision that requires these specific devices to be updated accordingly.
It's dangerous to assume, my friend.
Yeah, you can't just plug any Dolby Vision compatible device into one of these Sonys that have been updated recently and expect it to be able to produce a Dolby Vision compatible image. So keep that in mind. Again, with the apps built in, that's the best case scenario. Of course, those will work. There's nothing being plugged into the TV. It's just running off the software built in. But when it comes to, whatever the device, I'm thinking more for the ultra high def Blu-ray with Dolby Vision titles, and in particular that Oppo Blu-ray player, or of course Apple TV that also supports your Dolby Vision content now as well. That's really what I want.
Nice to have more options.
Yeah, so it's something to be aware of. Those updates have pushed. However, don't assume that any external Dolby Vision device is going to work. And we'll keep you updated on what's happening for 2018, because I realize now that's they've been rather quiet about how that's going to work. And I have a feeling it's just going to be the same as 2017 as far as the premium models go in terms of adding a firmware update down the road to bring it in. One other thing related to calibration I wanted to throw out to the LG 6 series owners, that could be your B6 OLED in particular. I had a chance to work on one of those recently, and I found that the Dolby Vision Dark preset was the most color accurate of the Dolby Vision presets when you're looking at that kind of content. With HDR playback or I don't know if HLG or not, but with Dolby Vision and HDR 10 content, you're given several presets, usually like a vivid mode, a standard mode, and a dark mode. For HDR 10, I find its standard mode for LG's TVs, on that 6 series at least, was the most color accurate. But when it came to the Dolby Vision content, switching to that Dolby Vision Dark or Dark Room preset, in terms of color accuracy, in terms of how it measured and how it looked, it was definitely closer to spec than any of the other presets I tested. So
to put this into context, right, the OLED calibration has pretty much been sorted and automated in Series 8.
Yes, the LG 2018 OLEDs. TVs make it easy with the right software and gear.
It was doable with emotional trauma, which we talked about earlier. We've talked about previously.
There's some methodologies, but it's a slog to get through.
And the 6 series OLEDs,
almost unusable.
Yeah, you had presets, and yes, if you didn't like the presets, that's nice. Choose one of the presets because there's no true calibration.
You get the standard dynamic range dialed in, and then you're pretty much at that point left with the presets available for your HDR content.
Okay,
so yeah, that's one of the benefits of, well, I would say also there are numerous benefits leaving that 6 series to the 7 in terms of just how the panel looked.
So,
but that difference between calibrating your HDR presets of all kinds, it could be your HDR gaming mode and things like that even, in addition to HLG, HDR 10, and Dolby Vision, that has gotten easier every generation. And the 8 series is going to be, I think, the easiest of all to produce reference quality imagery across all those different presets and different types of content you'll be looking at.
So one of the things that we were talking about last week was you were circling LG's B7, which is currently selling for like $1,500, which is the price that it was selling for at on Black Friday, which is
the lowest we've seen it.
It's like $750 or $1,000 less than it came out new. That is the same glass and processing as the $7,000, LG OLEDs. If somebody's looking at getting an LG OLED, is calibration a reason to wait for a Series 8 instead of getting a Series 7?
It depends. If you really want a reference quality display across all of the picture presets built into that TV.
Let me translate. If you are thinking about spending $150 to $300 to have your TV professionally calibrated, then...
Because most people... In that case, at that price point for calibration, it probably wouldn't matter.
Okay.
How many people, though, are going to be able to come into your house, though, and do, or wherever this TV is located, and then offer you, I'll do the Dolby Vision calibration, I'll do the HDR 10 calibration, I'll do the HLG calibration, I'll do the standard dynamic range calibration.
Well, what do you charge for that?
A lot. Because it's a lot. Every one of those is a separate piece of work, and it adds up quick. I start with like, hey, let's do the 2-point white balance and see how that works out. And on the 6 series TVs, I've had some respond as good as you could do with, say, a 20-point white balance setup. Mm-hmm. That's just for the standard dynamic range. And on some of those 6 series TVs, I had to go into the 20-point, which is literally 10 times the amount of work, and then go through and get an acceptable picture at that level. And then when it gets into HDR formats, it's like, yeah, you want those to look right as well. And on the LG TVs, it requires going through each one of those independently. Now, going back in time to that 6 series, there was just simply fewer and fewer controls or none at all.
Right.
It's simply all grayed out in terms of being able to make any adjustments to those HDR formats. For the regular grayscale setup, for your regular Rec 709 HD color, all of these TVs provide adequate controls and you'll be able to do it. Moving into that new 8 series for this year, for LG at least, that's going to be the easiest of all with the equipment I have, in terms of having a signal generator that's compatible with all these HDR formats, having a meter that can roll through it in a timely basis, and then to be able to offer that to somebody, in terms of like, hey, are you a gamer? Do you just want me to do every damn preset on this TV, or hit at least the standard dynamic range, high dynamic range, and maybe something else on top of that? But you compare that to, say, how Sony does their picture setup. Sony specifically says, we factory calibrate these like everyone else, and all you have to do is the standard dynamic range setup on our TV, and the values you apply for that setup mm-hmm. are then translated into the HDR performance. So in terms of the amount of time and work I have to put into a TV, Sony makes it stupid easy for me. I mean, like, not easy, but in the sense of, hey, I only have to do one thing one time, and it applies to all the different formats this TV supports. Now, the downside of that being, it would be nice to go back and verify that the TV is, you know, not only performing adequately with the HDR formats, which you can do, you just simply run the right signals through it and measure it, but say it wasn't quite perfect, could I then further optimize it? Using the controls built into the TV. And that's where at least LG offers that functionality right then and there. It gets easier the newer the sets become. But at the same point, it is literally double, tripling, quadrupling the amount of work and time you'll have to spend getting it to perform the way you want.
Right.
So I absolutely love Sony for the way they've done it. However, I do appreciate the way LG's done it simply because it can be very granular in terms of optimizing each preset for every type of content, and in a way that, you know, if you can further automate it, then I'm less annoyed about dealing with six different picture presets compared to just one of, say, the Sony TV.
Good to know.
Yeah. It's a lot of work. A lot of things to keep track of.
That's why they pay you.
Don't cross the streams.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, then your face melts. Got an answer back from Cambridge Audio. Class XA amplification is the improved version of our Class XD technology. We just renamed it for Edge so people wouldn't assume it's produced using Class D amplification, which is, you know, basically it's a Class AB design, which saves power, but they add voltage or bias to make to move the distortion into a place where it's not noticeable or audible to the human ear.
Very cool.
Yeah, and that's essentially what Pass Labs does and,
okay.
and several other extremely beloved and high-end amplifier manufacturers.
Oh, one
Again,
other.
I want to hear it.
Indeed. Oh, one other quick calibration thing. I had a chance to go back and look at, I think it's a 2016 Samsung 4K HDR TV. And you want to talk about how wacky it could be back then. Oh, and this is something I'm definitely checking out on their latest TVs as well, but there is no separate preset for HDR calibration on those TVs. It required you to literally use a separate input. So you'll feed all your HDR to one input, all your SDR to another input, and then you could have the option to calibrate both those independently. And who does that? Well, you know, I'm thinking like somebody with an AVR and a home theater setup. That just really won't work. And so, yeah. Progress is helping, I will say.
it's always getting nice when things advance over time.
I look back at some of that older gear, and it's like, oh, another B6 OLED. And I'm like, oh, man.
Here we go again.
Limited things we can do here. Right. I will take it back. I don't want to get into a whole calibration discussion here about this, but there are some color adjustments available. But when it comes to doing like grayscale analysis and adjustments, that's where things are a little wackier. And in terms of ease of accessing things like game modes mm-hmm. and different HDR modes and your standard to high dynamic range modes or standard dynamic range modes, that's where things are getting interesting going into 2018. Everyone's got some new ways of doing it, usually based upon how they've been doing it so far. And at least in LG's case, I will say things are getting easier if right. you can find the right person with the right gear. Sony's always made it kind of easy. I think especially for the home gamer, in the sense that you want to do it yourself, it would be easier to set up one of their TVs
right.
with gear you could buy on your own than it would be from at least up through 2018. We'll see what they're doing for this year, but I don't think it's changed. Anyway.
So the Sony would be easier to configure with your Spider colorimeter.
Without a doubt.
There's
like one set of work to do there. And
right.
then it kind of just applies that. It bases all the other setups upon that one piece of information. Which is kind of a throwback, in a sense, to what Samsung used to do with their rear projection TVs, where you would have to dive into the service menus, but you literally would measure the white light coming out of the TV and tell the TV what you just measured. And then the TV would then calculate the rest of the grayscale for you. And that on a projection setup, that worked really well. And speaking of which, I have a beautiful new JVC projector to calibrate tomorrow. And I'm looking forward to doing that. So we were just talking about the challenges of projection calibration last week. Well, I'll have some war stories to talk about after tomorrow. So, yeah.
If you hear weeping, it's Robert.
Now, the beauty of JVC and what they're known for is the best contrast you're going to see in just about any projector made today. It's just in terms of how black is black in projection setups. Mm-hmm. JVC is just kind of the acknowledged masters of that. Short of when you get into like RGB laser projectors, which nobody has at home except for maybe, you know, somebody with a hell of a lot of money. If you're throwing down $250,000 for a projector, that's a whole different ball game right there. But
a nice ball game.
I'm telling
but
you.
Not an inexpensive one.
Speaking of which, I would like to calibrate one of those Dolby Vision, Dolby Cinema caliber projectors that Christie Digital makes. I would like to anyway.
If you're out there, you need calibration.
Things I want to do, but
oh my goodness,
I'm busy enough.
If you're still listening, you got to be a fan of AVXL. And if you're not, well, I'm sorry. But if you are a fan, do us a favor. Head over to patreon.com/AVXL. Become a patron. Chip in a little bit every month. Helps us feed the habit of making this show for you and allow us to take the time to make it for you. And
man, I'm looking through the list of our supporters.
Who is our first patron?
The currently on our list. Mm-hmm. Scrolling all the way to the bottom here, on December 26th of 2015, a gentleman by the name of Philip Atencio was our, well, he has been our longest supporter.
Thank you.
For quite a long time. And I would say within that first 2 days, there's about a handful of people, some very familiar names too.
Yay.
And I just, a big shout out though to Philip for being the first one in there, at least on our current list. I don't know if there's that goes way back. So that's the very first one on the list.
We want to thank all of our patrons.
Indeed.
Because we appreciate it. Without you, we can't make this show. We actually got a comment on the AVXL website, a rare comment. Most of the time people either email ask@avxl.com. That's where if you have a tip or a question, or you're curious to see us review something, ask@AVXL's best place to go. Followed by at Robert Heron or at Patrick Norton or at AVXL on the Twitters. I think we've broken up with Facebook, but we won't talk about that right now.
Seriously.
Too soon. Michael wrote, thanks for the tip about the Blu-ray set of Battlestar Galactica. I grabbed them on Amazon before the price went up. As always, you guys always remind us that audio and home theater is supposed to be fun. Thanks. It is supposed to be fun.
Thank you, Michael.
We want to transport you to a magical place like Tahiti.
Heck
where
yeah.
You're so distracted by the glorious images and audio, we can operate on your brain and rebuild it after that tragedy. And if I'm creating spoilers for Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., you should have been watching the show when it came out.
Never saw it.
Oh, my goodness.
I wouldn't mind going.
Iron Fist.
I would like to see Tahiti.
Wouldn't we all? Just don't watch Iron Fist. That'll ruin Tahiti for you. I'm officially gone random, which means it is time to end the podcast. Thank you all for listening. AVXL.com is the website. We got an RSS feed and all that good stuff there. If you are a patron, you get early access to the show. And we got Hangout coming up, which you should have gotten an invite for. And if you haven't, I will resend that because I am sad and evil and I apologize. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Heron.
We'll catch you next week on AVXL.